You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 546. Accept no one's definition of your life. Define it yourself. Harvey Fierstein.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com.
Well, guys, today on the show, we have returning champion, Adrian Martinez. And you guys might remember Adrian as an actor who has been in every movie we've ever seen. Adrian's one of those actors who is constantly working, is popping up. Every time you're watching a TV show or a movie, you're like, oh, there he is. Oh, there he is again. And Adrian and I go way back. We've been friends for a better part of a decade at this point in the game. And he has now finally made his dream project. He has written and directed a movie that took him a long, long time to make, which is called I, Gilbert. And we're going to talk a lot about how he was able to make this film, what he had to go through, the ups and downs of making your dream project, putting your own money into it, and everything in between. So this is going to be a terrifying and inspirational episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Adrian Martinez. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion Adrian Martinez. If you can wake up, sir, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Alex, it's an honor to be here, and I thank you.
I thank you for coming back on the show, my friend. It's been a few years since you've been on the show. You were on early on, because you know we knew each other from Naleep and worked a little bit together on that stuff back then. And I asked you know, a giant in the field like yourself to come and to my humble podcast to talk shop back then. And now you're back, sir. And I appreciate you then and I appreciate you now.
Well, I couldn't be more grateful to speak to you because you know movies. And you know the price we all paid to make them. And so I'm grateful to be here.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about your new film, which is your directorial debut, I, Gilbert, in a little bit, which I love, by the way. And I'm sure there's a couple stories. I'm sure it was very easy to make, and it ran around very quickly. I'm sure the money just flowed in, and you shot it, what, in like a weekend? It got all the actors just showed up. It was great. Yeah. And yeah, and it got released
I'm
quickly.
Shooting it right now. Like, this is part of it.
So for people who don't, who aren't aware of your career, how did you get started in the business, man?
I was a complete and abysmal failure at everything else. Then I actually started as a teenager, and I was a high school sprinter, and believe it or not, they were going around schools putting up signs for a crime reenactment show called Unsolved Mysteries, and they were looking for sprinters. So my friend said, "Yo, you're the fastest one here. You should do it." And I was like, "I don't know. They're gonna pay you like $500 for the day. All right, where do I go?" And so the whole audition was a sprint, literally like a 40-yard sprint. And yeah, I was a medalist, and I left everyone in the dust, and I booked it, and I became SAG eligible. And now, just 87 years later, I'm directing my movie.
But were you method when you were running and sprinting at the time? Did you, what kind of acting techniques did you use?
I said, go for the money.
So
I had an objective, yeah.
There was an objective, no question. Now, you've worked with some of the best directors in the business over your long career. I mean, you're one of those actors who I constantly see pop up everywhere. You're just one of those actors who's always working. And it's so
I'm
fun.
I'm standing behind you.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're you're like David Pumpkins. You're like standing right behind me. But it's true, because I'll be watching a movie or a show on TV and with my wife, and I'm like, oh, there's Adrian. Oh, there's Adrian. It always puts a smile on my face. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. He's cranking along. I love it. And I love what you know, when you're doing your thing. And by the way, there is nobody else like you. Like, you have no competition.
Let's just keep it that way.
There's not an Adrian Martinez type. Like, you are a, there's nobody else like you. You have such a unique energy to you and everything you do. So, but all these shows you've worked on, all these movies you've worked on, you work with some of the best directors in the business. What were some of the lessons you learned watching them that you were able to bring into directing your first feature?
Well, I tell you, when I worked with Ben Stiller on The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, I learned all about hard work, because he produced it, he directed it, he starred in it, and he was the first one to show up, the last one to leave, and then he would go work on the edit. And I just stayed on him like white on rice, or in my case, off white on rice. And I just really just tried to learn as much as I could. But extremely powerful, hard work ethic. And then, of course, Sidney Pollack, rest in peace. I worked with him on The Interpreter with Nicole Kidman and Sean Penn. And this is a man who was just so, he has such understated power. Like, he ran this set, but he did it with a whisper. And you don't have to yell at anybody. You don't have to be a dick. You just have to know what you want and deliver the message with passion and commitment and authenticity. And he did that. And he knew how to speak to different actors as if they were each a fingerprint. And I was nervous. I was working with Nicole Kidman, and he's an Oscar winner. And I was nervous. I was kind of starting out. And he was just like, dude, you got this. You got this. You see that lady over there? And he's talking to Nicole. She's going to be there for you 100%. This is a safe place to work. So just take a deep breath and jump.
Yeah.
That was it.
You were done.
I was so moved by that. I, I still fucked up, but still, I was just very.
I mean, you almost brought the whole movie down, but at least you felt safe.
But he was so generous too. Like he told me, I said, "What about if I?" Because I was doing a scene with her, and I'm like the sound man in this booth, right? And I said, "What if she gives me the line? Can I leave my violin here?" And I say, "Number one, stop flirting. It's not going to happen." And he laughed. He's like, "That's absolutely ridiculous, but I want to shoot it." So, you know, this was an $100 million movie.
Right.
And he gave me the generosity of shooting that. And I don't know. I'll never forget him.
Did it make the cut?
No, of course not. It was absolutely ridiculous. But he gave me the time of day. He respected my idea. He believed in me enough to shoot it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were spending $300,000 a day on that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So each take is pricey. But he still let me do it. So.
And Nicole, I'm assuming. And I'm assuming Nicole cracked up.
She was like.
That's amazing. Yeah, Sydney was. I mean, he was a master. And you know, I've seen those directors who just their mere presence commands attention. And they're it's kind of like, you know, when you're Sydney Pollack, you know, everybody knows you're on set just by you walking on it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. Now, you've worked as an actor for many years now. And one of the things that actors have to deal with a lot is rejection. What is the mechanism that you use to deal with that? Because I mean, as a director, when I do castings, I'm trying to be as nice and kind to actors as possible. But you guys go, you know, sometimes on, especially when you were starting out, you know, 5 or 10 castings a day, and you're rejected from almost all of them, if not all of them, almost on a daily basis. And so you go through 100. I know. I'm sorry. Stop crying, Adrian. Out of a month, you might get one. You might land one if you're lucky. How do you deal with the rejection, man?
Oh my God, I'm having that Oprah moment. dude, this is the life I chose. And like my mother would say, nobody's forcing you. it's true. She would crook her finger like Gollum. Nobody's forcing you.
Right.
Thanks, Ma. But look, resilience. That's all it is. I was watching this documentary with Rita Moreno.
Yeah.
The one that just came out.
Yeah, it's great.
And she was like, you know, because she admits that she was actually raped.
Right.
By her agent when she was just a teenager. And,
kid,
and she fought through that, fought through the racism and the ageism and the this and the that. And they asked her how. It's just, you have to be resilient. That's it, resilience. There's no, and some people have a capacity for that more than others. And I understand that. A lot of my friends are no longer in the business, and I respect that. But you just have to fight and be resilient.
And I think that's something that every person in every part of our business needs to understand, from directing to gripping to screenwriting to acting. It is resilience. And that's what they don't teach you at film school. And they don't announce that. They don't sell that. Hollywood doesn't sell you that. They sell you this. I always say they're really great at the sizzle, but they suck at the steak.
Yeah. 100%.
Now, you also worked with one of the biggest movie stars, if not the biggest movie star in the world at the time, with Will Smith as a co-star on Focus. Were there any valuable lessons you learned from working with Will, and, you know, just being around someone who is so, not only so famous, but how he works and how he got to where he is? Any valuable lessons you learned?
Two quick stories about him. My first day, it's a scene. I'm in an ambulance on a gurney, and sitting over me is Margot Robbie and Will Smith. And we have no air in this ambulance. We have lights right over us, and I'm like in a polyester suit, and I'm dying. I'm sweating my ass off. And Will Smith reached into his pocket, took out his personal handkerchief, and dabbed the sweat off my head. And that was day one. We were in New Orleans, and I'll never forget it. And I said to myself, I'm going to be good on this movie. I'm going to be safe. Because if the biggest star in the world had the humanity to do that, I'm going to be good. So that's Will Smith that you don't read about. But he is like a parade float. He is larger than life. When we were in Buenos Aires, he came out of his trailer, and just like throngs of people, like the Beatles, just came after him. But what he taught me is treat everybody with respect. Everybody. Because you don't know who they are or where they've been. And he didn't tell me that, but he showed me that just by dabbing my forehead.
That's a great, great, great lesson. Now, I want you to tell me, so you've been talking about iGilbert for a couple years now. I remember, you know, we threatened to work with each other a little bit on that, on the post end, when you guys were trying to get something going or finishing up the film. Tell me about the film, iGilbert. What is it about?
Well, it's a personal story for me because there was a long time in my life when I felt completely disconnected to everyone. Just being Latino in this business, being a big guy, walking into, you know, a drugstore and just having people like, you know, look at you just because you're big or whatever. And I just kind of like let that simmer inside me. And then one day I'm on the subway in New York, and there's this guy sitting opposite this attractive woman. And he starts just taking pictures of her. And then he kept doing it. And she's like, what the heck? What are you doing? He didn't say anything. He was just dead. And then he got off the next stop. And I thought to myself, who is this guy that he is so dead on the inside that he could, you know, dehumanize someone in that way and just keep moving? So that stayed with me. And then, of course, I have a daughter. You know, she just turned a teenager. And I'm like, who is she going to wind up with if this is the dating pool, you know?
And I know the feeling, brother. I know the feeling.
And, and I reached a point as a person and as an actor that I just wanted to tell stories that mattered to me.
Right.
And what I felt was this growing disconnection between people. I mean, listen, we all love our phones and we all love social media, but it can be very isolating. So just like in Taxi Driver, the metaphor for loneliness was the taxi. Today, to me, it's the phone. And so that's how I started cultivating the story.
And how long ago did you start this process?
I wrote this maybe 10 years ago.
Wow, man.
And I shot it in 2016 and 2020. I had to do reshoots last in 2020. And then post-production was a real pain in the ass. I couldn't find the right composer. Mm-hmm. The music was so essential to this movie. But finally, it was an act of God because I was in Savannah, Georgia. I was shooting Lady and the Tramp, the remake. And I'm just walking around, and I see Leonard Maltin, the film critic, heading towards the screening over at SCAT. And I just liked Leonard Maltin. So I walked up to him. I said, Mr. Maltin, I love your books. They were really instrumental to me. I just wanted to say hello. And he said, thank you. Thank you so much. And he was with his family, a couple friends. And I was so desperate, I just blurted out, does anybody know the composer?
Leonard Maltin.
It was a total non sequitur. But I was just so like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I need a composer. I was acting the subway guy. Like, I need a composer. Do you know composers? And then somebody said, oh, I know somebody in New York. His name is Gil Tomey. Okay. Gil Tomey. And I went to Apple Music and I started Gil Tomey. And I heard this song that he wrote called Time Like Rain. And it was like a lightning bolt. It was just like, that's the tone of the song. That's the tone of the music I need for this movie. That's it. I reached out to him, and the rest is history. He and his partner, Gisela Fula Silvestri, she's from Spain, composed the most gorgeous score.
It is beautiful.
When you see the movie.
Yeah, it's a beautiful score.
Oh my God.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, and I kept trying to trip him up. Like, it's got to be sexy, haunting, sad, but beautiful. Like, I just kept throwing
and creepy, it. But fast, but and yet creepy. Slow.
Yeah, yeah. And I swear, he like took a leak, came back, and boom, there was this fantastic score. And props to my wife Emmy C, who wrote the end crawl song, and the song in the flashback. But that was it, man. We were off and running after I got that score.
So how did you get the funding for the film?
Well, that was hard. It was hard. That was the hardest thing I've ever done. I moved the money from savings to checking.
Did you finance this? You still finance this yourself?
I did.
Oh, man.
Which I don't recommend. I don't recommend that. I told my kid, listen, the good news is daddy's making a movie. The bad news is you're not going to college.
Yep.
But we'll see. We'll see.
But isn't it amazing, though, as filmmakers, you know, I call it the beautiful sickness, because we, you know, once you get bitten by the bug, you're done. You can't get rid of it. It's in your blood. It can go dormant for years and still pop its ugly head somewhere. And I had a director on the show who literally mortgaged his home for his first film. The movie bombed. He lost his home. He had seven kids. Had to move back in with his parents and his seven kids and his wife. And he said, the only thing I could think of is like, oh my God, I'm never going to get to direct another movie. And I'm like, that's sick. That's absolute sickness.
Yeah, but it's actually, for me, it was the same thing. I had property in New York. I sold it to finance the movie. And I have no regrets, because for me, the choice was, am I going to be an actualized landlord collecting rents, or am I going to be an actualized filmmaker?
Wow.
Living my bliss. The rest is history.
And
the money will come back.
Yeah, you know, if you look.
Don't worry about it.
Exactly. You did it. But you. So what took you so long then? If you had the funding, why did it take so long from the moment you wrote it to the moment it's been released almost 10 years later?
Because at first I did try crowdfunding. I tried all kinds of, you know, I reached out to friends in the business. You know, I went the route that you would, because who really wants to, you know, but it just came clear that, you know, it wasn't going to happen. And then I had a window and I said, that's it. I'm just going to shoot it.
And then you grabbed a few of your friends as actors and brought them in. And amazing cast, by the way. Yeah. Great cast.
Well, I feel like this is the best thing Dasha Polanco's done. With all due respect to Orange is the New Black, she just gives such a subtle, powerful performance.
It's beautiful. Like, it's haunting. It's almost haunting. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get people like Jean Marnon from House of Cards coming in, helping me out. She was terrific. Monique Kernan as the doctor. I love her. She's going to be on the show Ghost now. She just was on Power as a regular. Just good people, you know, good people. And, of course, Raul Castillo, who I met on a movie called Don't Let Me Drown that went to Sundance. And we always just stayed in touch. And I'm like, dude, he's a creep, but I need you to bring that heart you bring to everything. And you did. It was terrific.
Now, as a director, you know, there's always that day on set that you feel like the entire world is coming crashing down around you. You're like, oh my God.
It actually happened every day.
So what am I doing here? I'm going to lose all my money. And it could be for many different reasons. What was that? What was one of the many days of that, that you had on the set? And how did you overcome those moments? Because it's crippling. I've had it. I mean, I've literally had panic attacks when I was first directing. It's horrible.
Yeah. But it's also wonderful because you're telling your story.
Yeah.
The way I was able to do it was like I shot some short films in college. And so I said to myself, I'm going to do one short film a day.
Okay.
That's it. I'm doing one short film a day. And I did that 20 days. And then I said to myself, like, I remember one time we had a scene change and wardrobe forgot, you know, the change of clothes. And she was in Chelsea. We were in Harlem. It was rainy. Everything just sucked. And we were just sitting around, just kind of like waiting for the clothes. And I said, let's just grab the camera and let's just walk the streets and do some pickup shots. And in those pickup shots, I found some real gems. And it reminded me of who directed Babel? Was it Iñárritu?
Oh, Iñárritu. Yeah, Iñárritu.
Yeah. He was like, you know, just shoot. Like the screenplay is like the newspaper. It just changes every day. Just go out. If you see something interesting, just shoot that. And be open to the miracles. So I was. And I wound up having some really nice shots, kind of like B-roll stuff that we use while waiting. You just got to keep going.
Now, there's some shots in the movie that I know, because obviously this is not a $100 million movie, so I know you didn't get to lock off Grand Central, Grand Central Jason? What's the name?
Yeah, Grand Central.
Yeah, Grand Central, right. So I know you didn't lock off Grand Central, and I know there's scenes in, like, you know, that has a lot of production value. I'm assuming some of that was quote unquote stolen.
Not Grand Central.
How did you do it? Yeah, how did you do the Grand Central scene, man?
They will not let you in there. You gotta get permission, and you gotta pay them.
Okay.
Because they have their own movie person.
Okay, okay.
One night, and that was $8,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And for that you get a platform. You get access to one train not in use, and you get access to the main area, but they won't lock it off. So,
there were people. Those were real people just walking around.
Yeah, and then I said, okay. Now, originally in the cast, Gilbert gets his phone, and he nervously is recording someone. And then he drops it into a subway track.
Oh.
And originally I had it in his mind that he goes into the track to get the phone as a train comes by and jumps out of the way. And the MTA said, no fucking way. Because they were like, we don't want copycats of any of that. So then I had to improvise. I said, okay. He just records the person and he walks away, and then the stress of it, because he's not in good health, overcomes him and he passes out. And that's the movie. That's the scene in the movie you see. But originally it was a different kind of trauma.
Well, there was, for $8,000, actually, that's not bad. For the price.
It's gorgeous.
I mean, for what you get, I mean, try to build that set.
Yeah.
You know, the production value is not that bad for a day, and you get the train, and it's not a bad deal. But there were some scenes that were on the street. I'm assuming you kind of run and gunned it a lot of those kind of scenes, or did you always have a permit? You always had permission? Because I mean, I've talked to filmmakers who made $100 million movies that run and gunned it. So
yeah, no, a lot of it was run and gunned, but sometimes if you're gonna shoot something that's instrumental to the story,
sure,
like the Grand Central, you got to just pay the price.
Sure.
But yeah, some of it was run and gun. And interesting, John Carr, the DP, he had a Segway. And I think that's what you call those things you scoot on. Mm-hmm. And so we would use that for dolly shots. He would just segue from one place to the other. And we tried doing that at Grand Central, and they said, no, you can't use the Segway here.
Is that a direct impersonation?
You can't use
the person's right here.
The Segway is this generation's wheelchair, which was made famous by Robert Rodriguez in Mariachi, you know, using the wheelchair as a dolly. Now you can use the Segway as a dolly. You put that with a 100%. Ronin, you put that with a Ronin, and you've got like, you know, almost a techno crane.
Yep.
Now, what are the skills that you brought as an actor to the directing in this film? Like, you mean all this experience you've had as an actor, were any of those skills used in directing this film?
Well, absolutely. When speaking to other actors, because I get it. I know the price they pay.
Right.
And acting, it takes a lot of courage to be an actor. Because you are lending your emotional life to the character, to the story. And that process is harder for some than for others. So I knew going in how to speak to actors, and I knew each actor's different. If you're talking to, like, and I've seen Morgan Freeman say this, like, what do you want from a director? Nothing. I know what I'm doing. I don't want anything. All right, that's Morgan Freeman. Other actors want to get deep into conversations about objectives and backstory. Cool. Just talk about it, you know, as long as you want. On this set, Dasha was very much into Jana. She could connect to her story. And we would talk about her body dysmorphia and the character's body dysmorphia. And Raul was playing someone who has PTSD, and we wanted to talk about that and, you know, the price you pay to be a soldier and then come back out of that and to be back in the regular world and not being able to connect with the people that matter to you. So it was just like each person had their own journey to take, and you just have to be there for them.
That's the thing that a lot of directors, especially young directors coming up, don't understand when working with actors, because working with actors is very mysterious. It's almost like for many, you know, unseasoned directors, they look at what the actors do as magic almost. Like, how do you just turn it on, turn it off? I think one of the things you just said is so important for people listening to understand is that each actor is different and wants to be spoken to differently. Some come with all the confidence in the world, give me as little or as much as you want, and you're good to go. Others are much more not needy, but want more interaction with the director. And some need time to get into scene. Others can just pop, turn it on like in a dime. Some are method, some are not. But that's such an important part. And I'm assuming, you know, you working with the insane list of actors that you've worked with and collaborated over the years, I'm sure you've seen the gambit from everything I just said, yeah. Right?
100%. And whatever it is, give it to them. Because at the end of the day, people go see the movie, see the performances. You know, no one's ever said, wow, I really love the gaffer on this.
The gaffing was fantastic.
I mean, I appreciate the gaffer. We can't do it without him. But your movie will sink or swim on the performances. So whatever the actors lead on the day, give it to them. Just be there. Without judgment, just give them what they need.
Now, have you? I'm assuming during your travels, you've run into performers who might either have given you, not given you as a director, obviously, but you've seen actors who've acted up on set or not give, you know, like, you know, either ego or insecurity. How do you suggest directors deal with trouble, like, you know? Not troublemakers, but just people who might not feel safe. Because I know that for a fact, like if an actor doesn't feel safe, they start acting up sometimes, depending on who the actor is and where they are in their career. And others, you know, I just always love to hear any tips that you could hear, because I know that's one of the questions I get asked all the time. Like, how do you deal with a difficult actor if they're like the star, or if they're just how do you deal with them? So what's your suggestions with that?
Well, if you're another cast member, just like walk away and let the other people deal with it. This is not your battle.
Right.
If you're the director, you just got to pull him to the side. And hopefully there's a room somewhere where you could just let him vent. Because you have to keep the space safe for everybody. Mm. You know, one guy going off, it just brings everybody down. So if at all possible, you just pull him to the side. Validate his feelings, her feelings, and say, okay, tell me everything you got to say. Just let it out. Just let me hear it. And hopefully the person just needs that moment. I was working on a movie. Where was I? Baton Rouge. And Jeffrey Tambor lost his shit. I mean, he just went crazy. He just totally lost his patience, started screaming at everybody. And the director was just like, okay, 100%. I get it. Yep. And, you know, he just went on this 10-minute rant. That was it. We went back to the shot. And the rest of the day felt icky, you know. Mm-hmm. And the next day he came back, he apologized to the cast and crew in front of everybody. And we moved on. But that rarely happens. I haven't seen too much of that. Jeffrey lost his,
It's
rare.
And yeah, it's my experience. Obviously that's what all the attention goes on to, those kind of scenes, and you know, the like the Christian Bale, you know, breakdown and those kind of things. But in my experience, being on set as much as I've been in my career, I've never really seen that. Most people are professionals, and they don't act unprofessionally. At certain points, you do have breaking points, and it could be the cast, it could be the crew, it could be the environment, it could be financial, it could be you just got divorced, it could be a million things. It could be a million things. You never know what's going through an actor's head.
You just got to keep your side of the street clean. That's it. You know, from the moment you show up, you keep your side of the street clean. You're on time. You're prepared. You work and you go home. That's it. And you do that. That's the discipline. And to me, I wish the whole world was run like a movie set where everybody knew their role.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, nobody complains. We all do our job, and that's it.
And you get in and get out and move on. One of the best pieces of advice I ever heard was from a I forgot which director told me this, but he's like, if you want to know how actors are feeling, you become best friends with hair and makeup. Because they're the ones that are going to know they had a rough night. They just broke up with their girlfriend. They just got dropped from their agency or something like that. You're going to be the first to know. They're going to be the first to know. So always ask hair and makeup. How's Adrian doing today?
They're all like therapists too. I was a day player on something and I sat down and they're like, so you married? What's going on? They go right into it, man. And you know, sometimes they catch you vulnerable when you actually feel like talking about your business, and you may say things, you know. But that's a good analogy.
That's a good piece of advice for anyone listening out there. Make friends with hair and makeup, because they will know. And I think you were talking about it earlier. It's like, I think as directors, this is the one thing they don't teach you in film school, that we are almost psychologists and therapists on the set, because we not only have to deal with the actors and their emotional toll depending on the scene and the character and what they're going through in their own personal life, but you also have to run the set, and all of each individual, even crew member, has that kind of stuff too. So you've got to kind of, the politics of it all as well is something that they don't teach you. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, but don't let them see that. I mean, like,
you
go to the bathroom and scream and just like do whatever you got to do. But once you're back on set, everything is fine. Even if it isn't, because they look to you to know where this ship is going. And so that's really important that you set the tone, you know, like a conductor with an orchestra. You set the tone, man. You set the tone. I love keeping it light. I love keeping it funny. I crack jokes all day and night. Even though we were shooting a drama, I was making jokes all the time. And, you know, you just got to keep it light and keep it moving.
No question. I think, and that's a great piece of advice, because I remember my first film that I shot, day three, I excused myself, went to the bathroom, and I literally had a panic attack for 15 minutes and had to go through the whole thing. And I came back out. I'm like, I knew even at that early part of my career, I can't show what's going on. If not, the whole ship goes down. And that's tough. It's not easy being the captain. It's not.
Yeah.
But everyone thinks they could do it better. But everyone thinks they could do it better than you can.
Yeah. And maybe they're right.
Yeah, sure.
Today, I'm the captain.
So. For better or worse, we're on the ship. You know? Now, I always love asking actors who direct how they're able to direct themselves. Especially you. I mean, you're the lead of this movie.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So how in God's green earth can you not only direct your first feature film, but then also have the ability to direct yourself, be separated from yourself as far as performance is concerned, be objective? Because I've done it two or three times and I'm not an actor. And it was horrible, horrible experience for me. How did you do this on a day-to-day basis?
It comes very easily to me, very intuitively. I had no problem with it. I would block the scene, and my stand-in, Walter Cruz, would sit in, and he would I'd figure out what we're going to do. Then I would step in, I would perform. I maybe take a moment just to kind of like remind myself of what really matters to me in this scene. I'm just kind of like go there and shoot it, cut, check the viewfinder, look at the playback. Okay. Would I be willing to see this in a movie? Is this interesting enough to me? Do I want to make an audience sit through this? Yes. Good. Let's move on. No. Do it again. And that comes easily. What came hard for me was producing, because I love, having some money, but I don't like money. Like, I don't like dealing with my taxes. I don't like, I don't like any of that. So I remember like shooting scenes, and then just before an emotional scene, I'd have someone come up to me, Adrian, you have to sign these checks.
Oh, yep.
I'm about to shoot a scene here. Like, I know, but we got so you're signing the checks, that kind of shit. But writer director, no, I don't have a problem with that.
When I was doing my demo reel, shooting commercial, I shot $50,000 commercial reel back in the 90s when we had to shoot on film, and that drove me nuts. Like, okay, you signed these checks. I had my EPM come over, and I'm like, but I'm in the middle of the creative process, and you need me to sign freaking checks? Like, oh God, it's absolutely brutal. But hey, if you want to get it done, man, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. These are, as long as because what is it they say? Pain is temporary, film lasts forever.
Yep. Yep. It's like Kubrick's used to always say, he's like, we're already here. We're all set up. The lights are on. The cameras are here. Let's do it again. let's just do it again. See, let's just do it again. Because we all got here. This is taking a long time just to get us here for this moment. Let's take our time. Yeah. Let's do it again.
God bless Shelley Duvall, man.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. What she went through on The Shining.
Here's to you, Shelley.
God bless Shelley. Absolutely. If anyone's not seen the making of The Shining, get the Blu-ray, go online. 20 minutes of just watching Stanley Kubrick absolute decimate poor Shelley Duvall.
Oh, I love Kubrick.
Of course. But I think it was also his technique. And I this is something I've heard Coppola do it. And other directors do it, where they abuse their actors because that's what the feeling they want in the scene or things like that. And I don't personally like doing that. Kubrick obviously did it with Shelley. For better or worse, it worked because she was an absolute mess in that movie, looking wise, what her character was. I know Coppola tried to do it with Winona Ryder on Dracula. And all that kind of stuff. What's your take on that kind of stuff? I mean, I always like, just like, let the actors do them. If they need me to yell and curse at them, there's something wrong. That's my opinion. What do you think?
Again, it's the fingerprint thing.
Like, oh, you're right. You're right.
If an actor needs that.
And they're okay with it.
I mean, I'm not going to be abusive.
Right.
That's where you draw the line, of course. But sometimes, you know, you do need an actor just to be in your face and say, listen, this is what it is. This is what it is. This is the scene where you let her know that you're tired of her fucking bullshit. Mm-hmm. And you need to fucking nail it. Whatever it is.
Right, right. And you got to do what you got to do.
And then sometimes you go up to an actor and they're like, yeah, I'm hooked.
Exactly. Now, what surprised you the most about yourself during the process of directing and producing this film?
That I could do it. I mean, I took on a lot. Yeah, I took on a lot. And it came at no small price. I mean, there were times when I felt tremendous despair and terror because, you know, all kinds of things happened. People came and left. Locations came and left. The food didn't arrive. Meal penalty. You know, it just like it was just a series of tsunamis that you just have to grab your surfboard and just keep going. But it affected me. You know, Peter Brook says actors are athletes of emotion, and.
Mm.
I feel everything as a person, you know, like I take everything in. So to be able to compartmentalize that as a director and producer, to stand back and see the bigger picture, to allow myself to feel whatever agony I was in or whatever bliss I was, and just keep coming back the next day as if each day is a miracle. That was hard, but I did it. And I did it mostly because of the crew and the cast that backed me up every day without even knowing it, you know, like, and sometimes knowing it, but just knowing that they were there for me, that they believed in the story, that they gave me their time. No one got compensated a lot of money, but they were there. And just by the fact they were there was an affirmation of my vision and the story. And that kept me going.
It is the... It is the beauty and the terror of being an artist, is what you've just explained, is the ups, the peaks and the valleys, the bliss and the despair that could happen within a minute, a second of each other. At one moment you could be at the highest of the high, and the next moment you could be at the lowest of low, and it could turn on a dime. And that's unique to the filmmaking art. You know, I'm not sure it is like that with photography or with, you know, painting. I don't know. Even with writing, I definitely think it is, as you know, because you wrote this. How long did it take you to write this, by the way?
So I write very slowly and very quickly. And by that, I mean, I was just cooking with this idea for a year or two. And then I banged it out in a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, of course, obviously, that was the first draft. And Jose Rivera, who wrote and got an Oscar nomination for The Motorcycle Diaries, mm-hmm. he's my EP on the movie. And he has a writing group where I brought it in, and I would have other writers read different parts. And Mojah Marnot was in that writing group at the time. I knew I wanted her in the story. I just love her. Mm-hmm. I just love her look, her presence. She's so smart. But yeah, there the script took different, you know, stories, different lives. Let's just call it a year.
Okay, fair enough. Now, besides composing, was there any other part of the post-production process that you would like to warn filmmakers that have never made a feature about, like the kind of a couple of hiccups or pitfalls that you might be able to fall into in the post-production process of this?
Just remember that when you cast the movie, you're not just casting the cast, you're casting the crew, and you're casting the post-production people. You got to be with people that are highly vetted, that come from personal referrals, people you trust. Like it was Oscar winner Shaka King who told me about the post people in my movie. And he said, yeah, go here, go to this guy. That's it. I believe him. Yeah. I mean, he shot the king. But this is before he blew up. But we did a movie together called Newlyweeds that went to Sundance, his first movie. And he's been very, very helpful. I thanked him in the credits. Good man, smart man. But that's definitely the truth. You got to really go with people that are vetted and recommended and trust them and work with them. Make sure they're collaborative. Make sure they get what you're trying to get after. If you get any whiff of this guy doesn't know what he's doing,
go walk away.
Yeah, that's not the one for you.
The main question I have to ask you, would you do it again?
Yes, but not with my money.
I think it was Peckinpah or John Ford or somebody. I forgot who it was. Like, never use your own money. Never.
Yeah, I say that, but I just shot a trailer, kind of like a proof of concept for a pilot I'm putting together with my own money. So, you know, but that's – I told my wife, that's it. That's it. I'm not going to
shoot a pilot.
Yeah.
For everyone not watching this, Adrian just rolled his eyes, and which insinuates that there might be a potential of him using his money again. It's a sickness, man. Listen, it is a beautiful sickness.
I just want shit done, man. I don't like waiting for permission from anybody. I don't like, you know, I mean, obviously there are limits. So I'm not going to shoot a series for Hulu on my dime, but
sure.
But I can shoot a trailer for a proof of concept, and that's what I did. And we'll see how it plays out.
Now, you have I think you have an announcement for your next project. Isn't it called Renfield? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Very exciting. Just came out on Deadline yesterday. I'm going to be Awkwafina's sidekick in this movie. So it's me and Awkwafina versus Nicolas Cage as Dracula, and Nicholas, and I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Forgive me. Nicholas Hoult.
Uh-huh. Hoult. Okay.
As Renfield. It's going to be good. It's directed by Chris McKay, who did Tomorrow Wars. He's really smart.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be funny. It's going to scare the shit out of people. It's going to be good.
It's Nick Cage. Have you worked with Nick? Have you worked with Nick before?
I did. I did a movie called Army of One.
Yes.
Where Larry Charles directed it. I don't think it went anywhere, but it was fun to meet him. It was fun to shoot it. And it's about a guy who wants to kill Osama bin Laden. So he's like, it's this guy from the Midwest, just got himself to the Middle East to try to kill Osama bin Laden. And the comedy ensued. But yeah, I worked with him. He's very nice man, very nice man. And a real artist. People realize, I mean, Nicolas Cage, you know, he went through this patch where he was just doing whatever to make money. But let me tell you, this guy can act. He's a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
And, He's got this movie coming out where he plays himself.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. Oh, yes. Yeah, like, I'm the greatest actor in the world or something like that. It's an amazing title. And Nick, I think he's acting for like a billionaire off like some foreign billion. Oh, I saw the trailer. I was just like, yes, please. Can I have a double? I mean, I can't get enough of Nick. I think Nick is.
Yeah, no, we're at the precipice of another Nicolas Cage renaissance, and Renfield's part of that. And I'm really psyched.
Oh, that's amazing! I can't wait to see you. You work with him and Awkwafina. She's amazing right now.
I love her. Yeah,
I just saw her in Shang-Chi, and she like steals every scene she's in. She steals it. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
She's absolutely.
I'm fantastic. Just gonna try to hang in there. That's it.
Now, where can people see iGilbert?
It's everywhere streaming right now. So. Amazon Prime and iTunes and movies and YouTube and IMDb TV. Like, it's everywhere streaming. So just write I, Gilbert, and enjoy the movie. And let me know how you feel at my Instagram, Taste of Adrian.
Which is a fantastic handle, by the way. I've always loved that handle.
I mean, it's just a taste, you know.
We can't take all of the Adrian in. It's too much. No. It's too much. Too much. You have to take a taste.
Just a taste of Adrian.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions. Ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Don't waste time. Time is the enemy. Time doesn't give a fuck. Time just keeps moving on. So grab your phone. If you don't have a camera, just grab your phone. Shoot. Don't make excuses. No one's interested. I don't know how to write. Find somebody who does and collaborate. Just keep going and don't waste time.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Don't waste time. I wasted so much time. That's why I'm saying this. Absolutely. And also be professional. I mean, you know, we all know this, but it really matters to be kind. Like, people remember kindness more than you think.
Well, the best advice I ever got in the film business is don't be a dick. So,
yeah,
that's a really, yeah. People underestimate that. By the way, on your first interview, do you remember what your answer was to that question last time you were on the show? Because it was one of the more profound answers I'd ever had on the show up to that point. No pressure.
eat salads? I can't remember.
It was, I'm enough.
Oh, yeah.
I'm enough. And I was like, wow. It just hit me like a ton of bricks when you said that. And most people don't realize. They go through their whole life thinking that they're not enough. But when you realize that you are enough, it's pretty liberating. So I thought I just wanted to bring that back because it was such a wonderful answer. And it was the first time anyone had ever said that on the show. Many people have said it afterwards. They probably all stole it from you, sir. But but it was a very profound answer. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, Alex. I mean, not only are you enough, but who else can you be? Do you know what I mean? Like, I forget who said it. Like, I think it was Oscar Wilde. Be yourself. Everyone else is taken.
Absolutely. Oscar.
So.
Amazing.
It's really about embracing who you are and bringing that gift and trusting it, trusting who you are, and just really, there's a light inside you that people want to see. So just get out of your own way and show it.
And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Man.
As of right now.
Well, yep. Well, number one's always Shawshank Redemption.
Amen. 100%. Amen. Mine too.
Kind of like with the theme, you know, like get busy living or get busy dying.
Yep.
I love John Cassell. He's a hugely inspirational actor to me. So I think of Fredo and The Godfather. I think of him. So The Godfathers 1 and 2. Okay, I'll throw in number 3 because I just feel like Godfather 3 gets a bad rap, but the new cut I liked a lot. I've never seen it.
I haven't seen the new cut yet, but...
Yeah. It kind of streamlines everything more.
I mean, but look, after Godfather 1 and 2, it's really tough. Like, Godfather 1 was a tough follow. Then they beat it with Godfather 2 in many ways, or even equaled it or beat it. I mean, how many times can you hit lightning again?
Yeah.
You know, it's tough.
Yeah. And how many more I got to give?
Just one.
One more. Shit. There's a movie called I, Gilbert, which I just saw.
I hear good things about that one.
Really spoke to me.
I heard the lead actor was but the rest of the cast and the direction was fantastic.
If you just fast forward his performance, you just really get a really classic film.
Mute his performance. Mute his performance. And then just unmute it when he comes off.
Yeah.
My friend Adrian, I appreciate you coming back on the show. I wish you nothing but continued success in everything you do. I'm so glad you finally got this film made because you'd been talking about it for a while. You've been talking about it for a while, and it has just been I'm just so glad that it's finally done. It's out in the world and that you survived it. And you're threatening to do it again.
Yes. Last man standing. I mean, I swear the Martians could drop a bomb and annihilate the Earth, and out of the rubble, my hand will come with my demo reel. Just like, take it to your leader, motherfucker.
Oh, my God. And then Will Smith comes out for some strange reason from somewhere.
Always.
Always. Always. To save the day. Adrian, continued success, my friend. A pleasure as always.
Thank you,
Alex.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I want to thank Adrian so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Adrian, thank you so, so much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his film, I, Gilbert, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/546. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.